This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Sowing Prejudice, Accuracy and Research in Writing.
So this week was suggested by Jules.
Yeah, and as usual with an episode that's suggested by me, it's because there is a bee in my bonnet buzzing quite loudly. First things first, this isn't necessarily me going off on a tangent, so I'm just going to very briefly talk about the television adaptation of Chernobyl. Now, if for some reason you've missed this or you have no idea what this is, on the 23rd of April 1986, in my living memory, and I do actually remember this happening, although obviously I wasn't in Russia or the Ukraine at the time, a bit young to be travelling at age six, the Chernobyl power plant, one of its nuclear reactors, exploded and then went into meltdown. It's a great series. The thing that bypassed me back in 1986 when I was a very small child, wondering why people were getting sick, and my dad explaining what nuclear fission was to me at a very early age. Because I was not a kid you could fob off with half an answer. I had to know the whole thing, even if I didn't understand it. What I didn't really grasp at the time was the lengths that the Russian government and President Gorbachev and the KGB went to in order to hide and sow disinformation. And to the point where when it actually happened, yes, there was elements of gross misconduct and incompetence and the fact that the people were just not trained. A serious fault had also been hidden. And then there was the things like it was the attitude at the time. You know, this was the SSR at the time, so it wasn't even Russia as we'd know it today. This was, you know, everybody, you addressed everyone as comrade kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was very, very much a communist state. And they did things that were cheaper. And you do not do things just because they're cheaper when you have a nuclear reactor. It's just a really, really bad idea.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a very good idea at all. In fact, if there's ever a time to, you know, splice out on the more expensive stuff, it's probably in that particular case.
Yes. So without going too far down the very fascinating and horrifying details, both the biological implications and everything they had to do in order to try and get a hold on it, the thing that struck me most immediately and sort of left me with outrage through the rest of the programme was the way that those in charge, because it was such an intense culture of blame and responsibility, the first thing they said was, no, don't be ridiculous, the core's still there. Of course it hasn't exploded, it's impossible. As in, we're sending people out to check, and they're coming back and saying, no, the core's not there, and their faces are melting off, literally. And we're still saying, no, they're lying. Every one of them is lying, kind of thing.
Yeah.
People are dropping down dead. We're lying about it. And nobody wanted to deal with it. And it was that level of denial, and I'm not responsible. And, you know, I get it, because no one wants to catch a bullet with their teeth from the KGB, which was kind of where you were going. But
yeah,
at the same time, it was just horrifying. So that's an example of just how bad things can get when people lie. If you want a more recent example, obviously the Chinese government went into massive denial about the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yes. Which was obviously a little bit more serious than...
And once again, it fell to a scientist and a doctor to say, no, this is wrong. We have to tell the truth, which is obviously what happened with Chernobyl as well. Why we now know much more about it years and years later. And there's been examples of this littered throughout history. I'm not just picking on Russia and China or anything. We've done it ourselves. This idea that something is the way it is just because we say it is without backup knowledge, without evidence, and in spite of the evidence is the thing that really gets me. It's the in spite of the evidence thing that triggered the first part of this.
Yes.
So the second part is something that's a little bit more funny, but also kind of more depressing in a way. Okay, not more depressing than Chernobyl, but, you know, depressed in writer terms, it's more depressing.
Yeah.
And that is, I just need to quickly grab something.
Something wrong?
No, no, I need the exact wording. I need the exact wording for this. Right. Da-da-da. Sorry about this. I did have it and it's obviously just kicked me out of the thing, which is no good.
No problem.
I'll cut this bit out.
I thought you were going to keep it for ambience.
Right, where are we? Okay, so where does this take us when it comes to writing? Well, obviously I have opinions about this because I have opinions about everything.
Jules has opinions. What a shock.
No. Jules, an opinion shocker. That doesn't necessarily mean my opinions are correct. It's just good to start from a position of having an opinion and then working or reverse engineering or even coming back from having an opinion. Mm. So I am just going to read a very short passage to Madeline. It's from a literary novel that is recently released. Okay. And I just want her impression.
All right. Okay.
The dyes that I used in my dressmaking were composed from various ingredients, depending on the colour required, but almost all required nightshade, sapphire, keyswing, the leaves of the silent princess plant, octoroch eyeball, swift fifth violet, thistle, and hightail lizard. In addition, for the red I had used for Abrilla's dress, I employed spicy pepper, the tail of the red Lizalfos, and four Hylaean shrooms. So, just want to do a little talk about writing and research based on that. Now, hopefully, listening to that, most of you are scratching your heads and going, what's an octoroch eyeball? Or, you know, if you're somebody who perhaps plays games...
Yes, I had actually seen about this, and it just goes to show a cursory Google search may not be exactly what you need.
So, to fill people in, this is from John Boyne, celebrated Irish literary author's new novel, A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom, which is set between AD 1 and AD 2030. Basically, I think in each of the 52 chapters, it changes POV, as in it's the same character, but being reincarnated through time, etc., etc. He has these characters being various different cultures and races, etc. And he admits himself he's done next to no research.
Not great, to be honest.
No. That list of ingredients was actually kind of plagiarized from one of the Legend of Zelda games.
Yes, very particularly a bunch of creatures which don't, and things which don't actually exist in real life.
Yes, so if you're wondering what an octoroch was, don't worry, it's not actually a thing. At least not in this reality.
No.
I am throwing something at John Boyne here. I actually have read a couple of his books and liked them, but there have also been his books where I've gone, oh god, that's not right.
Hmm.
And the worst thing here is that he looks like a wanker. You know, the worst thing with a list of Legend of Zelda ingredients is that it looks like somebody who can't be bothered to research his own books.
Yeah.
But later on, there's various other things where he has characters acting in ways that are, you know, diametrically opposed to their culture without explaining it, and various other things. So that's an issue. He was the writer of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which is woefully inaccurate and actually very, very insulting to a lot of the Jewish community, and has been pointed out. And the way he sees it is, you know, sod it, I'm a writer, I make shit up.
Yeah.
And then his most recent one, which was aimed at fairly sort of early teens, late sort of 12, 11 year olds, is a book called My Brother's Name is Jessica.
Yeah.
And that caused uproar amongst the transgender community, quite rightly, because this is a book written from a cisgendered person's point of view about their trauma of their brother turning out to be a sister. I'm not going to go into that too much, but again, this is insensitive. So on the other end of the scale, on one end you've got, yeah, you just look like a wazzock. And on the other end of the scale, you've got, oh no, you give a shit about nobody except yourself and you're too lazy to do proper research.
Mm.
And not only that, you are willing to let whatever you put out there and your platform and your status as a literary author harm other people.
Mm. Yeah, that's when it starts to become a problem. I mean, it's one thing to just do a little bit of laziness and accidentally include, you know, a reference to something which doesn't necessarily exist. I mean, that's a bit of lighthearted fun and something which really ought to be have been caught. But it raises warning flags. And actually, yes, on reflection of looking at the rest of the content, it's a difficult subject because on the one side, as writers, we want to have the freedom to write whatever we want, to tell the stories we want. But on the other hand, you have responsibility as well. And particularly as a literary writer, being, you know, very held up in it's something I've never really understood. Like, great, if you're a literary, you know, writer, brilliant, wonderful. Literary fiction doesn't actually sell that much.
No, which is why so many prizes are focused on literary writers.
Yeah.
they kind of need the money.
Yeah.
it's very difficult to make a living as a literary writer, even if your books then go on and become great, great classics. And few of them do. But that aside, yeah, it's really bad because it gives you a certain cachet and a certain platform and people think, well, this is someone who's a literary writer.
Yeah.
They must know what they're talking about. They must have really done thorough research. Which is obviously not the case.
No.
I will say, you know, Boyne is... I read his book, The Heart's Invisible Furies, and parts of that to me read a little bit like... They weren't magical realism, but they've read like magical realism because some of it was just... I kind of thought he was making a bit of a satire about it. But what I did feel that he got right there was how lonely it was to be a queer person in Ireland during the 1980s. Mm. Which, you know, is true. It was illegal to be gay in 1980s Dublin.
Yeah.
It's not anymore, but, you know, it trailed behind the rest of the UK by quite some margin. And, you know, actually it wasn't really safe to be openly gay in the 1980s, full stop, as I recall. But I suppose the thing is, I don't agree with the whole stay in your lane argument.
No.
I think most of those are redundant. With the big however, and the however is that it doesn't give you the right to absolutely pillage anybody else's culture, race, or very particular experience. So it's kind of, there are some stories that it's actually not really your place to tell. Mm. And you have to be sensitive to it. And if you decide to go ahead and tell them anyway, then you better be bloody well doing your research and you better be speaking to people who've had those experiences so that you're handling it sensitively.
Yeah absolutely. The thing is that just because you have the freedom to do something doesn't mean that you should.
Yeah, very definitely.
And I'm not actually about restraining people from writing whatever they want to write. I think that telling people to only stay in their lane is actually going against one of the major parts of writing, which is about empathy. It's about empathizing. Something I think a lot of people forget, particularly, you know, in children's fiction, one of the big things is about sort of promoting empathy in children. And writing is about basically stepping into somebody else's shoes, because if we all only wrote about our experiences, literary fiction would be incredibly boring. Not just literary, just literature would be incredibly boring if we only wrote about our experiences, particularly if people had only written about their experiences for a very long time. So I do think it's very important to explore different things and to engage with empathy as well. But the point of engaging with empathy is that you do actually have to engage with it. It's not enough to say, well, I want to step into somebody else's shoes and then write that person completely inaccurately, because you're not stepping into their shoes at all. You are stepping into a... You're stepping into your own mindset. You've not actually left it. You are staying within the lane that you sort of originally started in and forcing it into another point of view, which is inaccurate. So if you are going to write about anybody, I say go for it. Go for it. Write about anything or anybody. But actually make sure that you're writing about them and that you're not actually writing about you and your opinion of them. Because that's when real issues start to arise. And the problem, of course, is that particularly white, straight male authors, but also, you know, female authors as well, but particularly white authors, are the most predominant face of the publishing world at the moment. So if they are the ones who are currently in charge of all of the stories about people of colour and, you know, trans people and queer people and all of that, if they're in charge of those stories, if they're the ones distributing them, you've got to understand that if even half of them are getting it wrong, that is going to actually have a lasting impact on their readers' impression and understanding of all of these minority groups.
Yeah, definitely. So where we're going, slightly around the houses maybe, but where we're talking about accuracy and research, we're not saying create a textbook. We're not saying create a piece of nonfiction unless that's what you're already writing. We're just saying you've got to do your due diligence. Unless you want to become part of the problem, and we'll go into the problem a little bit more in a moment. Absolutely, writers need to be able to write, or at least operate in a space where they can write whatever they want to write, and they need to be allowed to make mistakes, and all of us do. For instance, I tried very, very hard to be accurate with my recent historical fiction novellas, and there is one tiny bit where the reconsecration of a church after blood is spilt there did not take several days. It actually took a few hours. And I looked everywhere for that piece of information and I couldn't find it. And it turned out somebody else had it and, you know, pulled me up on it, which, fair enough. But that's a very, very minor thing that hopefully hasn't really cast aspersions over an entire race or minority. Hopefully.
How dare you!
But yeah, I mean, for me, it turns into a bugbear. It's kind of like, oh my god, I've left an inaccuracy in there. And at the end of the day, it was a very small thing, and I didn't mean to do it, and it was just one of those things. You will make mistakes. But deliberately going, let's have a quick look on Google. Yep, that list looks about right. No one's going to notice.
Yes.
that's not okay. So yes, you have the power to write whatever you want to, but that power, like all power, comes with responsibility.
Yeah. Spider-Man was right.
Okay, so let's look at this statement. I'm a writer, I make things up. What's wrong with being inaccurate?
Well, it's a little bit like, whenever I see things like this, I always think of the whole freedom of speech argument.
Yeah.
Which is, people grossly misunderstand freedom of speech. It's basically about being able to say things without fear of legal repercussions, unless, of course, you're, you know, using slander or something like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I get to say this and no one can argue with me. If you say something, then people also have the freedom of speech to turn around and call you an arsehole. That's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So, definitely. Whatever, actually, you're right. You can write whatever you'd like. But you can't then get annoyed if people turn around and say, this is gross misinformation, you're an arsehole, how dare you do this, and then totally blacklist you. And, you know, that's the tamest response as well, I'd like to point out. Because then the other fact of the matter is that, yes, you absolutely can write what you like, but once again, we get into that area of responsibility. And actually really looking at the effect of what you are going to be writing, and whether what you want to write might actually hurt somebody.
Yeah, definitely. If you just take the attitude of, I'm a writer, I make things up, then on one end of the scale, again, the least of the problem is that you look like a wazzock when someone points out how grossly wrong you are. The worst part of it is you might actually twist the facts and continue perpetuating a harmful stereotype and misinformation. So picking on John Boyne again, the boy in the striped pyjamas, it was considered such a classic, accessible for younger readers, that a lot of schools took it on as a literature option for secondary school. And the problem was there was no world during the Second World War where that would have actually happened, where you would have had a young German boy, the son of a Nazi, and a young Jewish boy from a concentration camp nearby, where he would have actually gone into this person's house, and they would have been in a position to strike up a friendship. It just would not have happened. And that's the least of it. There's lots of other inaccuracies in there as well. And the problem is you're then giving it to secondary school children because it's an accessible text, and saying this is what the Holocaust is about. We're wired to learn through story, by the way. Far more than, you know, you ever think how you read a book and you thought it was wonderful and you could think of whole pages of it or whatever later on, and then someone gave you a textbook which essentially contained very similar information, but it was so much harder to make the facts sit in there.
The thing is, with the boy in the striped pyjamas, I get the feeling like the whole point of the message is that this idea of it could be you, and that actually not everyone in Germany during, you know, the Nazi regime were evil, and that children aren't born racist. And, you know, you have all of these kinds of concepts that are being played with, and also the child perspective and the way that children understand the world around them. You have all of these ideas which are being played with. The fact of the matter is that the Boy with the Striped Pyjamas, I don't think it was initially actually published to be a children's book. It was just something which then kind of became a children's book. And I think in that way, the ideas that it's exploring are actually overshadowed by the story itself, which is full of inaccuracies. At which point, if you wanted to just explore the ideas, you could have very easily written just what could have been a fantasy novel, just set it in another world, a different time, you know, a parallel sort of universe, and you could still explore the same story in the same way without it being grossly inaccurate.
But without taking the entire suffering of several different minorities.
Yes.
So lightly. You know, this is something that has really scarred racial memory for sort of the Jews and the Romani and, you know, groups of disabled people, and gay people, etc. So this is a real issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I did... It just makes me think, I think something that people, you know, forget a lot about is that the Nazis, it is within memory. It is absolutely within memory. It's not some distant thing. It's not like calling back to, you know, the Tudor era. It's not like calling back to sort of the ancient world. It's recent. Now, that doesn't mean we can't write about it. In fact, I highly encourage people writing about it. But I always just think about the fact that when I go out walking with my grandmother, we were just walking through the village, and through up the hill, and there was this huge clump of trees, and she pointed to it, and she said, "That's where I hid when the Nazis came." Yeah. And I thought, by God, you know, you don't even think about it, but yeah, there she was. She was this little girl whose father was in a prison of war camp. Her mother was hiding the resistance in her house and so had to be pally-pally with the Nazis. This is within living memory. This is not something of the ancient past. These traumas, which existed, live on today, and their effects live on as well in our parents' generation. These are not things which have just disappeared. And particularly for those, you know, the minorities, the Jewish people, the Roma, gay individuals, but most sort of minorities who the Nazis picked on, these wounds have not closed. So you have to actually be considerate when you're looking at them.
Definitely. So that's one area where it's really, really important. So if you're writing anything with a historical bent, even if you're writing fantasy with a historical bent or based on history, you ought to know what the actual facts are. The problem is, obviously, history has been selectively edited.
Yes.
Very, very definitely. And the people who would have had access to do that are obviously male, mostly straight, white, usually British, in fairness. Obviously, later they would have been American, but we were all British to start with, guys. So let's remember that. So we end up with this myth. So, for example, you know, give yourself a point for every single one of these that sounds like, yes, I genuinely believe that up until recently, or I still believe that until you said it just now. So, in the Dark Ages, people were ignorant and they didn't wash.
Yeah.
In the medieval era, women only bathed once a month, men only bathed twice a year. Women didn't do anything except stay home and raise children.
Yeah.
Women played no part in history. There were no transgender people in history. There were no queer people. In fact, queer people tended, particularly gay males, basically they would be put to death for it. And a lot of these things are inaccurate. We've had no gay marriage. That's a very recent thing. If you're saying yes to all of these, by the way, all of these things are completely inaccurate. They're not true. And the problem is, if you learn a little bit of history and then you read a little bit of Shakespeare, and let's be honest, Shakespeare wasn't exactly big on his own research.
No. Shakespeare was amazing, a giant playwright. Propaganda machine, and he knew who he was writing for and he wrote it.
Yeah, and you know, hats off, he wrote for his target audience and he did it bloody well, but at the same time, what he actually wrote was not historically accurate. You cannot take your history from Shakespeare. No. So it's not enough to say, oh, well, I read Julius Caesar and I read Henry V and that's how things happened. It's not the case
Macbeth
at all.
In particular always gets me because it's so unspeakably inaccurate.
So, yeah, this is a real problem because history has traditionally removed women, people of colour, LGBTQ+ people and other minorities.
Yes, it has, systematically, to the point that actually we don't even consider it anymore. It's just been completely sort of scrubbed away. And it's actually really amazing because you suddenly catch yourself going, hold on a second, why am I picturing it this way? Even if you know, logically know something. For instance, when I've used this example before, but when I think of Victorian London, you know, I have the image in my head of all of those old, you know, the Granada Sherlock Holmes things. I have that image in my head. I'm like, well, that's what Victorian London looks like. There were absolutely no other people except white people. Obviously, I know this is not correct. This is so blindingly and obviously not correct. And yet it's in my head because I've got that visual. And that visual obviously comes from, you know, certain pieces of writing, which were all from white men. And the Victorians, as we've said in the past, were so great at just scrubbing history so that it looked like how they wanted it to look like.
Yeah, and even more recently, as we talk, as, you know, the last rags of the British Empire were gradually sort of handed back and we withdrew. And, you know, this idea of whenever someone says the word British identity, I'm like, the British identity was made up circa 1963 by the MP Enoch Powell, who happened to be quite a wordsmith in his own right. But it was inaccurate, and it was done very deliberately because he wanted this particular vision of Britain. And it led to things like race riots.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we hear about the civil rights movement in America. There was a civil rights movement for black people over here. It was smaller, but it was still here. There was the Bristol bus bike boycott, for example. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I can't go into it now, but go away and research it, guys. Research it, you know, look at it properly.
It's amazing. Fun fact, I stayed up incredibly late last night till about 3 a.m. because I suddenly got this itching desire to write down all of the monarchs of England, starting with Harold Godwin. All the way down to Elizabeth II. And I wrote down all of their names. I included Lady Jane Grey, and I actually put in Cromwell as well, because even though he wasn't king, you know, he and Robert Cromwell, you know, both sort of ruled. And I put down the dates in which they ruled, and I wrote down little fun facts sort of beside that. Fun being, you know, that's about perspective, I guess. You know, like sort of William Wallace era or Crusades or, you know, little bits and bobs like that. And I was listing them all down. I had this huge A3 sheet of paper and I got them all down. It's this long list and I was like, yay! And here, right at the bottom, is where slavery ended. And here, in Elizabeth II's reign, is when we started to actually allow, we returned independence to all of those countries that we stole. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, see, I mean, and that's the thing, and I'm not part of the, oh, we must self-flagellate forevermore if we happen to be British, and, you know, because that solves nothing. This is not a sins of the father situation. However, we should absolutely know what those sins
are. Yes, we should. And it's something which is very commonly kind of erased, this idea that, oh, you know, these things were a long time ago. No, they weren't. They absolutely weren't a long time ago. And
this is living memory for a lot of people.
Yeah. And also the whole idea of British identity, you know, list anything which is British, I guarantee you it's come from somewhere else.
Fish and chips.
Actually, no, that was brought by the Jewish people, I think from Portugal, I might be wrong in this, who brought it to England with them when they migrated.
When was that?
I'm just going to check. Hang on. Fish and chip, because I'm not going to give inaccurate information, she said. The Jewish immigrant Joseph Mallon opened the first recorded combined fish and chip shop in London in 1860.
Well, he had a brilliant idea. Thank you very much. Yorkshire puddings.
Yorkshire puddings. That's a good question. Where did Yorkshire puddings come? I almost guarantee they're not actually from Yorkshire.
Probably not.
Yorkshire pudding. I type it in. It's got all these recipes for Yorkshire puddings. I think I might be the only English person in existence who doesn't actually really like Yorkshire puddings.
Oh my god. It's something that kind of grows upon you with age, I think.
Like a mould.
Like a mould, yeah. It's like quiche. It's like, I always used to think quiche, I'm really going off on a tangent, I always used to think quiche looked nice and it smelt nice and I hated the taste, but I kept trying it periodically over the years, and then one day in my late 20s I was like, oh god, yeah, quiche Lorraine, this is great, this is really nice.
I've always loved that. Hang on, let's see. When wheat flour began to come into common use for making cakes and puddings, cooks in North England devised a means of making use of the fat that dropped in the dipping pan. Okay, I'm getting this from Wikipedia, so, you know, you could still take it with a pinch of salt. But it does appear that actually Yorkshire puddings are from the north of England. There you go! We have one thing!
Obviously, there are other little bits of things, but that's the thing. There's a lot of cultural sharing going on as well. So, yes, you know, there'll be things in France and Germany and other places that will have originated over here as well. So, yeah, so getting back here. So if you just make shit up about other cultures and races which are not your own, mm-hmm, then your platform adds to the problem of prejudice and racism, yes, and sexism. If we keep, for example, without touching the huge, huge race issues, which absolutely deserve to be looked at and addressed, if we just take the whole, my experience of learning history, women never did anything interesting, women never invented anything, women never really accomplished anything, except maybe for Elizabeth I. We might mention her sister, Mary, next to her, just as a contrast. We might mention Mary, Queen of Scots as well. They'll get a passing mention. And then there were no other women who did anything right up until you get to Marie Curie and Elizabeth II.
Oh, and Victoria.
And Victoria, obviously. And that's it. And you'd think there were no other women in history. I think we got one brief look at Boudicca as well.
Yeah, and Joan of Arc was briefly mentioned.
Yeah. Although technically French, not.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
We're talking history. But yes, you're absolutely right. And you'd think there was nothing. In fact, this is not true. There have been as many women stirring the pot and doing things and accomplishing things and inventing things as men. It's just they're not talked about. All their discoveries are reappropriated and stolen. So, you know, you want to say things like, for example, Einstein's first wife actually came up with mathematics for the theory of relativity. They wrote the paper jointly together. We actually have letters proving this. And then Einstein took her name off the paper and took all the credit for the theory of relativity, which got him the Nobel Prize. He was a great husband.
Wow.
Stand-up nice guy. Not a lot of people really like to hear that, by the way. It's not that he wasn't brilliant, but he wasn't a very good mathematician. And she may well have come up with the initial idea for the theory of relativity in the first place. We don't know. But the fact that she understood the mathematics suggests that she was more in a position to come up with it in the first place.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's Watson and Crick. Actually, it was their it was their female companion who came up with the idea of the double helix for DNA strand. And they went, oh, no, that's rubbish. And then Watson and Crick went off to lunch without her, sat down and said, so, I think the DNA might actually form, you know, nucleotide pairs and come up with a sort of rope ladder type effect, a double helix. And again, submitted it, got Nobel Peace Prize for it without actually ever mentioning the fact that the original working was done by a woman. So, you know, these things obviously really bug me, but it's proof that when these things get written out, when someone writes a book about the great discovery, you know, a fictionalized account of the great things that Einstein or Watson and Crick did, or any other inventor, 9 times out of 10, there was a woman helping them.
Yeah.
And growing up as I did with women didn't do anything just plays into the narrative of you will never do anything because you are female. You have to be so exceptional in order to do it.
I think it also plays into this mythos of things which actually continue to affect a lot of women today.
Yeah.
Which is that women historically only had children. That was the power that women had. It was the only power that women had was the ability to have children and to be wives. And that's where they wielded power, by marrying correctly, by having healthy children, by being successful mothers. And a lot of emphasis was put on that. And even the sort of the powerful women, a lot of their kind of the way that we even explore them is in reference to their families, you know, is in reference to maybe they did it as revenge for their husband, or even that they were unique because they remained a virgin. They remained pure. They never married, which makes them a little unnatural as women, which makes them sort of men, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And they continue to perpetuate this idea that is the 100% natural role of a woman. To the extent now that, you know, if a woman nowadays turns around and says, actually, I don't want kids, I can't believe that people say that's so selfish. That's so selfish. Why don't you want kids? That's so selfish. You'll change your mind.
Ever since my mid-20s, complete strangers have felt perfectly free. And I mean complete strangers have felt perfectly free to say, do you have children? Why not? You don't want children. And literally come up to me and say, why don't you want children? As if I'm somehow failing the human race.
Yeah.
We wouldn't do that to a man. So this isn't a sour grapes thing for my sex or anything. This is just a kind of, this is rude. That's a really personal question.
Yeah.
Why is it acceptable to say that to me because I happen to be female? And it's a roughly sort of 60-40 split as to whether it's men or women saying it as well. So more women say it to me. It's very noticeable that they're nearly all women who have children and somehow feel I'm invalidating their choices by choosing not to have children.
Yeah.
So yes, if all you do is write books that show women having children, etc., there's nothing wrong with that, but explore the reasons why, explore the choices, show that there was a choice, or show why there wasn't one, you know? Don't just make it as well, obviously she has children because she's female, she must do.
Yeah. And particularly don't scoff at authors who give their female characters agency.
Yeah.
That's inaccurate. No, shut up. It isn't inaccurate. Be quiet.
So, yeah, it's not actually unusual for women not to want to have children. You can go through any number of medieval tracts where, yes, your options were not so broad, but women who have quite happily gone into nunneries or, you know, the church or what have you, because they didn't want to get married and have children, which is understandable considering the high infant mortality rate.
Yes.
But also just a case of, no, I don't feel this calling for husband and family. I want to study. I want to learn. I want to improve my mind. I want to focus on those things. It's not actually that unusual at all.
No, not in the least. It's totally allowed.
So, yes, this is the accuracy thing. This is you might choose to go in a very traditional direction with what you write, but if you do, make sure you've asked yourself the questions first as to why you're doing that. And have it on the page as you know, she once thought she wanted to do this, but actually found she was very fulfilled by home and family, etc. And that's okay too. Obviously, not quite that baldly, but you know.
No, but I mean, you can also. We're not necessarily saying right, all of your characters need to be like this. Not in the least. It is also possible to have a character who is just. I say just, but it is sort of a housewife in whatever era, you know, stays at home. But also understand that doesn't mean necessarily that they just sat around doing nothing. Even if they were, you know, from noble families, they were still very much a part of the running of the household, which took a lot of work. And also it's perfectly possible to have them being like that, but also actually not being happy with their lives. Well, and to show that too, and to say, actually, I don't feel fulfilled by this. I dream of something else. Very often you just have, if you have the sort of mother character, they're just 100% content to just be the mother character. And it's like, well, no, that they have an identity beyond mother. Let them be that person. Even if it's only on a very small scale, it's okay to also show people having a bad time. They don't all need to be having a wonderful time. You can't. you don't have to go sort of, well, girl power, and have all of your female characters all living their dreams. Because that's actually not even realistic to nowadays either.
Yeah. In fact, let's explode this myth as well while we're at it. If we're looking historically, women didn't just get married and have children and keep the home. No, that's what they did in addition to what they did for work. So if you were a noblewoman, the reason your husband could afford to go off to war was because you were home to defend the castle, so you acted as the commander in his stead. If you were say you married a baker, then you were a baker. The baker would be allowed one other apprentice, legally.
Yeah.
Because he had a wife who was able to take on a share of the workload. You'd only get paid 1/12 of what a man got paid, by the way. But,
of course.
But you were officially a baker as well. You were doing all these things. If you were married to a blacksmith, you were also a blacksmith. And you literally, there's any number of accounts of female blacksmiths in the medieval era who had, you know, they were very, very highly celebrated. Some of them made so much money they just could retire and they lived in relative ease. You know, they moved up a social class because their work was so good. There were some where it was a case of, the customers came when the male blacksmith was clearly busy with something else because they knew the wife was actually the better of the two craftspeople. Same with carpentry, with anything else. Same with forestry, which meant if you were married to a forester, then you were out with a bow and arrow, and you were out with a saw, and you were chopping down trees and keeping game. Women joined the army in the medieval era, not necessarily openly, and usually they did it under male names because technically you weren't supposed to do it as a woman. But if you signed up under a male name and your lord needed to raise X number of men for the king and he didn't have enough men, but hey, there you are, you happen to be a skilled archer because you're a forester's daughter, then yes, they'll sign you up under a male name. It's fine.
Yeah.
And for all those people out there, women aren't strong enough to wield swords or axes or draw a bow. Yeah, there are women who are bigger than smaller men. There are big men who are bigger than women. You know, it's a relative thing within either biological sex.
Yeah. It also makes me think of the way that sort of in history men recorded women, like Cleopatra, for instance. they just said, oh, she's just very beautiful, she's very beautiful, but she's a snake. And like, no, she was fairly average looking, to be honest.
She was actually described as being quite ugly, but having this very, very sort of glittering charm.
Yeah, she was incredibly intelligent, ruthless and ambitious and intelligent, and actually did some pretty amazing things before everything went to pot. We don't even actually know that she committed suicide. This was very much popularized by Shakespeare. It was Shakespeare who popularized it, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. But we don't actually know what actually happened to her. It's the same with Boudicca, actually. I think there was this Roman person who reported on her saying how she had this, she was huge, she had this really rough voice and things like that. And it was this fact that they were like, okay, so first of all, we need to make sure that people understand she's detestable as a leader and shouldn't be worthy of any kind of praise because she's a woman. But we also need to make it so that there's less embarrassment about the fact that she's defeated a bunch of the Roman army. So we need to make her this unnatural woman. And so they do this long description of what she looks like, which is of course based on nothing, because the guy who was writing about her had never met her before in his life.
And was actually writing after her death.
Yeah.
So, we've gone down a little history sidetrack here, and it's not just history where you need to do your research. I mean, obviously it's important with history, because don't just quote from the book of the big scholar, everyone. You know, everyone knows this, therefore it must be accurate.
Yeah.
Because everyone doesn't know shit, basically. Everyone doesn't know shit.
Everybody doesn't know shit. That's why it's also important to not just trust Wikipedia.
Yeah, Wikipedia is good at pointing you to sources you might like to check out. It's not the place to stop.
No, it's a serious overview place. And don't get me wrong, you know, there are lots of people who've invested a lot of time on Wikipedia to make it as accurate as possible. But for overview, fine. But if you're actually doing research, you need to go deeper than that. Definitely. You absolutely do.
Okay, so you're writing something speculative. You're writing a piece of science fiction. You're writing fantasy. You're writing paranormal. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're making shit up in those quarters. So, and you probably should be, because it's not a very satisfying fantasy if it just reflects real life.
Yeah.
On the other hand, let's think about viable access points. Now, what I mean about a viable access point was, if you made something up completely in its entirety and it had no familiar parts at all, you would not get your readers on board because it would be too weird. There would be nothing there which they could connect with and draw empathy with. So, yes, you might have something that's populated entirely by alien creatures which are not bipedal, which don't have pentadactyl limbs, what have you. Mm-hmm. And Gary Gibson's done this with one of his trilogies of science fiction books. They're kind of like big goldfish type people. I've described that very badly. There's more to it than that. But when push comes to shove, even though their culture and their morphology and everything else is very different with these alien characters, there's enough there that you can latch onto it as a human. There are things there that you can understand in the way that they're making choices and acting within the narrative. And, you know, there's various other things like the concept of space itself and spaceships and the fact that they're kind of homes within, travelling homes within the solar system.
Yeah.
So you're actually not making up as much as you think you are. You're basing it on things that we already know. Because it wouldn't be a satisfying story otherwise. So yes, you need these access points. It's the same with fantasy. It's why so many epic fantasy writers base things on what they understand of history. Because people go, oh yeah, I recognise that. And it cuts the world building in half for a start. But it also means that there's a doorway, there's a portal that the reader can go through and still feel like, yes, they're going somewhere fantastic, but home isn't too far away.
Yeah. I'd also like to point out that as a writer, it is actually impossible to separate what you know and what you've experienced and what you understand from the world from your writing. You could be writing the most abstract thing in the entire world, but unless you're writing literal gobbledygook, your own perceptions are going to bleed into your writing. Which is particularly why, if you are not part of a minority group, you've really got to make sure that you research that minority group to ensure that your perceptions, even if very innocently meant, you know, even if you have the best intentions in the world, and even if you think, oh no, I've completely separated myself from this, I'm not a racist person, it doesn't matter. You've actually benefited from a racially biased system. You have internal racism. Everybody really does, to be fair. And that perception unconsciously will bleed into your writing, which is why it's very important to actually really engage with what you're writing about to ensure that your perception is as accurate as possible.
Yeah, so for example, if you have 7 point of view characters, mm-hmm. and you suddenly realise, oh god, they're all white, or they're all male, or they're all straight, it's not okay to just play finger of God and point at one and say, you are now a woman, and you are now queer, and you are now black, because all of those things are very different perspectives and experiences in terms of living. Your experience of coming up through, I don't know, say a military training system in space may well be very, very different if you're female than if you're male. It may be very different again if you are queer or yeah. if you are black, whatever, there will be things there that make your experiences different. It's not okay to just put a mask on a white character.
Yeah, particularly if you are, it's not even that you're just not writing about a particular experience. So it's not even that I'm not writing about the black experience here, but because you're actually specifically writing about the white experience. Sorry, that sounds like the same thing, but it's almost not. It's like this idea people have that the white character is the neutral character.
Yeah, it's the norm.
And that everything else is the norm, and everything else is... It's not. They're different things. So you'd be writing about one very specific kind of experience. Now, if you happen to be writing in some future universe where everything is 100% equal and it's just, you know, there's absolutely no differentiation, you know, between the colour of your skin or your orientation or anything like that. You know, if this is like a Star Trek sort of thing where it's all just recognised and racism has been abolished, she said, then yes, but you still have to consider the fact that the experiences that you have aren't just to do with actually negative things. It's not just about... and this is also another thing. People go, oh... you know, the homosexual experience is just being consistently abused by everybody. Or the, you know, the black experience is just being people being consistently racist to you. No, there's also, you know, the question of actual, the sort of the cultural heritage as well. The language which is used at home, you know, the number of family that you might even have. For instance, if your character comes from a, you know, strong sort of traditionally Catholic Mediterranean family, they're likely to have lots of family, she says, from great experience. There's likely to be a lot of them. This is all part of the experience. So you need to consider that as well.
Definitely. Okay, let's look a little bit at the research process, because... the word research, you say it to writers, particularly newbie writers, and they kind of go a bit sort of pale and wobbly, and it's actually not as intimidating as it sounds.
It's not, actually. I think it's really fun.
Yeah, it can be really fun. I mean, basically, if you want to write something, presumably you're interested in what you're writing. At least I hope you are, yes. Because that's a really good place to start.
It's a very good place to start.
You should be, in theory, you should find the process of researching and finding more out about what you're writing quite enjoyable to some extent. I mean, maybe not the tiny details, and there may be areas of it that don't interest you as much. But generally speaking, it should be kind of an enjoyable process. Hot tip, if you're interested in something enough to write about it, then you should probably care about how it's depicted. And if you can't say that you're A, both interested in something and you care about how it's depicted, then you probably are not writing the right book and maybe should rethink what you're writing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you a little story, which was that a long time ago, a long, 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 long ago, when I was doing my GCSEs,
it's really not that long ago. It's not as long.
It was very long.
It's not as long as my GCSE.
When I was a child, and I was doing, I was doing my GCSEs. I was bad at chemistry, like really, really bad at chemistry, and. At the same time, I was writing a story which included alchemy. And I wrote this story, this alchemy, and as part of writing about alchemy, I started reading a lot on alchemy, and as part of that, a lot about chemistry. And... sort of, I started to actually include within the story some actually very complicated things. And someone messaged me, someone who I'd sent it to, they sort of replied saying, "Are you a chemistry major?" And I laughed until I cried. because they thought, first of all, they thought I was at university studying chemistry, and I was like, absolutely not. She's like, this is some really interesting, like, this is some really detailed stuff, and, you know, this is accurate stuff as well. I'm like, listen, I'm failing chemistry. But for the research purposes, considering that my dad basically had to sort of, was basically chasing me around the house with a chemistry book going, read it. And that was just me shrieking, going, no, you can't make me. I suddenly realised that I'd spent literal days researching chemistry without even thinking about it. All for the sake of writing.
So, yeah, it's funny, really. It's funny how essentially the same thing can be fun if, well, yeah, it's the application. It's the whole learning through story versus learning through a textbook. I think if you've already got an interest in the textbook, then you've probably got more tolerance for it. But
yeah,
research can definitely be fun, and you should be researching and writing something that you actually enjoy and are interested in. I swear I pick my historical fiction time periods based on the fact that I just go, oh, I don't know very much about that time period. In fact, I know almost nothing. I think I'll write about that one, which is like a really stupid way of doing it because it increases my workload so much. But I do learn a lot in the process.
It's, yeah, absolutely. And bearing in mind, of course, that actually when people pick up these things, it will actually affect how they understand history. And how they understand history will reflect how they understand the modern day. A while ago, I watched Da Vinci's Demons, which is obviously completely historically inaccurate, because it's meant to be. Because it's like a, you know, a magic realism.
Yeah.
Retelling of that focuses on Da Vinci as a character. I don't really see the problem with that, considering that, you know, we've been using Da Vinci for all sorts of reasons in most fiction. Da Vinci's old blueprints were found, so we were able to make helicopters, and Da Vinci's old blueprints were found, so we were able to make these huge blimps, and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
Based on an old drawing by Da Vinci. So
I mean, you wait, if I ever write about the Renaissance, then Da Vinci is definitely going to crop up at some point.
Hell yes. So I had no problem with it. My partner refused to watch it because he was like, this is just inaccurate. Da Vinci was not like that at all. I also watched Doyle and, oh God, what's it called? Houdini and Doyle. And again, my partner refused to watch it because he was like, this is inaccurate. They were not friends. You know, they had a very difficult, these are real people. But the fact is that you go into it with the understanding that this is not historically accurate. It's not meant to be. They're not portraying it as historically accurate at all. So on the one side, that's sort of okay. It's really ultimately about how you portray things. So it's absolutely fine, for instance, if you want to write historical fiction, which is totally inaccurate, but then don't portray it like it's meant to be accurate.
Yeah. I feel like we've gone back to historical fiction here. We're actually talking about methods of research.
Yes, sorry. But what I mean is that, you know, in terms of research, you know, you could say, oh, I want to have this buddy story between Conan Doyle and Houdini. And all the research I say says that actually they, you know, even though they disagreed on this, they actually really disliked each other as well. There was a real problem and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just going to ignore that research.
Yeah. I mean, the problem there was the fact that Houdini was famous for debunking things. And obviously Doyle wanted to believe.
Yes.
He was into the spiritualist movement, which was what Houdini was debunking. That was the main root of their argument, as I recall.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole premise of Houdini and Doyle was they literally just said, we just want to have this buddy kind of thing where one of them believes and the other one doesn't, and they're constantly fighting about it.
Okay, so research can reshape your plot into something more dynamic, or, you know, it can certainly add more richness. Just admitted that I knew very little about Richard II before I wrote the King's Knight series, and I certainly didn't know how I was going to get my main character, my cantankerous knight, from one part of the continent to another. You know, what could possibly summon this mercenary home? And I ended up, I mean, I lost an entire day to working out how much a loaf of bread would have cost based on socioeconomic mm-hmm. political factors during the 14th century. That is how big a nerd I am. But what came up in the midst of that research was something called Prima Sessam, which is what happened in the medieval era when, I mean, obviously all the land belonged to the king, technically, but the understanding was that the king would reign, he would never rule. The actual rulership would be largely through the government, although obviously king has the right of veto. This is something that, that you know, got more and more extreme as the years went on. I mean, the king still had a fair bit of power in the 14th century, but he could never do exactly what he wanted. Otherwise, his nobles would have risen up against him and overthrown him, which, you know, is what happened to Richard II when he tried to do exactly what he wanted. So this Sessam Prima thing is the fact that when an estate passes out of one lordship's hands because he's died and there is no clear male heir, then it reverts to being the property of the king, and he can reward it in theory to whoever he wants. If, however, an heir then turns up, they have to go through the process of proving who they are, and then and then paying a fairly hefty fee to the king, which usually equated to 1 year's worth of the entire estate's income. Which was, you know, for some estates would have been really hefty. We're looking at the equivalent of, in today's money, would have been millions of pounds. That goes into the royal treasury, and then the king says, "You're right, you exactly are who you say you are. Arise, sir, baron, whoever, etc., etc." That's a very, very light take on the whole thing. It was a bit more intricate than that. And it was, I thought, I know what I can do. I've got it. My knight character can be at odds with his family and can find out they're dead but a year afterwards, so that the estate has reverted to the custodianship of the then 14-year-old king, and he has to find the money on this dying estate in order to then get to the king and say, "Hey, can I have my father's lands, please? Here's a big bag of cash." Which, again, it's not quite how I've done it in the story, but that is essentially... But it gave me a direction. And once I had that, I had that starting point, everything began to fall into place, because the fact that the estate was ruined just came naturally. And the fact that then, okay, well, if you can't earn the money and you need to own the estate in order to earn money from it, but it has no money because your wastrel brother has spent everything, then you have to marry money. That's the only way. Who's going
to
marry?
And thus, Jules was able to use her favourite trope of the marriage of convenience, which forms into love.
Well, I don't know. It could have formed into murder at one point. You know, it really could have gone either way. All the pieces then fell into place, and obviously it's at the background of the Peasants' Revolt with the first book. So, yes, research is, you know, it can be fun. It can actually help you guide your plot and shape it into something that's a lot more dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing more fun when you're researching than when something appears and you suddenly go, "Oh!
Oh, it's perfect! It's perfect!" Madeline's got quite used to me messaging her at all hours of the day and night with, did you know, oh, you've got to read this thing that this monk wrote. You've got to read about it. Is it me, or is this Jewish rabbi, like, really, really obsessed with Gentile genitalia?
Yes.
For example. Except I won't say that. I'll just send it to her and she'll come back with, "Yeah, he was all about the Gentile cock." Direct quote.
Writing excessively about it.
So, yeah, it can be a lot of fun. There is also the fact that it doesn't need to be exhaustive. I'll tell you about my research process in a minute, but you don't have to know every single last detail. There's room for minor mistakes. There's room for you not... I mean, to be honest, the amount of research you're going to do and the amount of that you're then going to apply to your book are vastly different anyway. So you're going to do loads of research and actually only apply probably about 10% of it. But because you know your subject, it'll come through in the writing anyway. So it doesn't have to be exhaustive. You're not looking to become a doctor of medieval history or anything like that.
No. But also you'll be surprised how the research that you do will suddenly actually become very useful for you in conversation later on, depending what kind of friends you have.
Yes.
Or not, just depending what kind of person you are. We're sitting at dinner, there's silence, and I start my usual thing. There's just a thing in my family where they all just wait, and then I go, "Did you know?" And I can see them all collectively go, "Here we go."
They brace themselves.
Yes. So it's actually quite fun anyway.
Yes. So bringing this fairly closely to a close, but this is just a little bit about how Madeline and I individually approach research. And it's a personal thing, and you can go about it however it suits you, ultimately. In my case, I like to know as much as I possibly can. And for me, that usually means seeking three independent sources of verification, because I don't trust just one person. So particularly for historical fiction, if I'm looking at, let's say I'm looking at Henry V, I want to read at least three books written by three different authors, specifically looking at Henry V as a person. And then I want to read some books around it as well. If you're sat there thinking, that sounds like a lot of work, it is a lot of work, but that's what I'm comfortable with. That's the level of research I'm comfortable with. Wikipedia is fun for getting the timeline roughly right and pointing you in the right direction for new sources and things you haven't thought of. I'm not someone who researches and researches and researches for years and comes up with piles and piles of notebooks full of stuff and just wedges it in. I tend to do a couple of months of reading around a subject whilst I'm writing something else, and then I will start the new thing, and I will keep researching and fact-checking as I go through and until I finish the book, and then obviously I'll fact-check again when I'm editing. And that seems to work fairly well for me. It's certainly most people who've read my historical fiction say, oh yeah, that's actually pretty accurate. And you know, what I'm looking for is pretty accurate, and in areas where I've had to fudge things because we just don't have a record, people have said that actually it's plausible. So that's good enough for me. For things like when I'm writing urban fantasy and I'm portraying a trans character, or I'm portraying a person with a very particular mental disability, again, I will read accounts by people in that situation, or people close to that situation. I'll read any sort of biological research that's necessary as well, because in that instance, that's not just a case of, oh god, I've got them all riding to war on Shetland ponies, that's which is an accident, that's a sort of potentially harmful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I have a very simple approach to research. I ask tools.
You do some research of your own.
No, I do. Because I don't actually write that much historical fiction. The historical fiction that I tend to write is actually around periods that I know quite well. And also because a lot of the writing that I've done is based on my own experience and the research I had to do for academia. It's very hard to say sort of how I approach it, because these the two things sort of go in tandem. And also, you know, I write about fairies a lot. I've been researching them for literal years, because I've just been reading more and more, both for the academic side of things and also because I keep writing books about fairies, so I keep learning more and more about them. And then, of course, Jules supplies me with even more, which is excellent, and then she sends me references and we exchange things like that. So it's sort of like this build-on effect. In the same vein as Jules, when I'm writing about people whose experiences are not my own, what I tend to try and do is actually to get in contact with people who have had those experiences, and to very closely read and look at the accounts of people who are whatever I'm trying to portray. For example, one thing I'm trying to write, one of the characters has frontal lobe epilepsy.
No,
temporal lobe epilepsy.
Wrong side of the brain.
Sorry. Wrong side of the brain. I keep mixing those two up. I do actually know. I just keep mixing the names up. And of course, I have a very good source for that. She's my source for everything. But otherwise, it is based a lot on my experience for the most part and the collective research that I've done. I think if I was going to write historical fiction from historical periods that I don't know very well, right now the historical periods that I know fairly well are the Victorian period for very obvious reasons, and sort of the late Georgian period as well. But if I was going to go sort of a little bit further back, and let's just not talk about the Tudors, because the Tudors are sort of a given, I would probably have to read about 3 or 4 books to get that right. And I would be consistently researching and reading and watching things as well. But watching things with a pinch of salt, to kind of really get a feel for what it looks like, feels like, yeah, and what actually occurred.
I mean,
and I'd also try and get 2 stories which looked at different perspectives of what was happening as well.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that I will say is, when you're doing your research, yes, books, definitely, yes, the internet, obviously great resource. Don't rule out sources like YouTube, and don't rule out things like people's blogs. I mean, one of the best resources I've had for historical fiction, not necessarily for the overall detail of the time period, but for things like mindset and the interactions between men and women and queer characters, it has been Dr. Eleanor Janiger's blog, Going Medieval. And since our social interactions are always informed by both politics, socioeconomic factors, and by, you know, just how we live day to day, you get a pretty big picture just looking at things from that angle. So there's that. There was also an excellent article about jousting as well. Brilliant article about jousting. I knew a fair bit about jousting, but that really sort of nailed down a few of the tiny details, so it sounded like I'd actually tried it myself, and I can assure you I have never tried jousting in my life.
Not in this life.
I'd kind of like to now.
Just once.
Just once. It probably would be just once. That would be it.
Oh, dearie me. But yeah, for the most part, I just go to Jules. That's how I start my research.
If you have
Jules.
Yeah, obviously another resource, knowledgeable friends or sensible friends who you say, does this sound right? And they say, I don't know, but you could ask so-and-so. That's always very helpful as well.
Yes, very, very helpful. And yeah, there's just lots of ways of approaching it. There's lots of ways to do it. And a big part of that is actually just getting other people to vet it as well.
Yes.
To take a look through.
Yeah, obviously don't Google something and then write down a list of ingredients from a video game.
I just can't believe that. That's next level failing at Googling.
Yeah, it really is. Your Google foo is weak.
Which site did he even go to? Did he look at the site he was getting it from? What was he looking at, Wikia or something like that? Oh, for goodness sake.
I'm afraid I don't believe he Googled it. I believe he pulled a half-remembered gameplay out of his arse and just wrote it down.
I can't quite believe it. It really does boggle the mind, because that is just astonishing.
Yep.
Anyway.
when 50 Shades of Grey starts looking more accurate, then yeah, you've got real problems.
No, don't even say that. Okay. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week I've got one for you. I recently finished watching season 2 of The Umbrella Academy.
So did I. We didn't buddy watch it. I watched it just after Madeline had finished it.
Yeah, yeah. It was very good.
Yeah.
Actually. It was quite sweet. I really, really liked it. A really nice follow-up of season 1. You see a change in some of the sort of the dynamics as well. Just a lot of fun, generally. I think they did an excellent job continuing the story. And I've got to say that the romance in this one feels significantly more comfortable, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I guess with the first one, when we're talking specifically about Vanya, it was very... She was being, you know, rooked, wasn't she? She was being very deliberately deceived. He was a serial killer, for a start.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I'd agree with you. And it continues that wonderful found family trope whereby, you know what, they don't all really like each other all the time.
No.
They've got the same problems and dynamic issues between characters that you would find in any large family of siblings. But it was believable, and when push came to shove, everyone pulls together. So,
yeah, definitely.
That was really good.
It was actually very sweet, and I did enjoy it. Some very funny content in there as well, and also some very relevant content too.
Definitely.
I think. So well worth watching if you enjoyed season 1, and if you haven't watched season 1, that's also well worth watching too.
Yes.
And on that note, guys, we're going to say thanks very much for listening. We hope everyone is keeping well, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.